The one thing I wish I'd known 10 years ago, think I'm gonna say is that often as a black woman, it's the system, not me. So there's always this point, and it's happened across, it's happened at work, it's happened in situations where you're like, is it just me? Or, and I'm like, no, it's not just you. This is the system you're operating in. It's the system that maybe at points you're in a system or space that's not built for you, that's not made for you, that was actually deliberately designed to exclude people of your heritage, background, gender. And I think just understanding that would have saved me a lot of pushing and yeah, a fair amount of burnout, I guess, as well.
That's a really interesting point in that I spoke to Kevin Morosky, who is episode three, who's
Of him,
Kevin's brilliant. And his new book is called Black Women Always, and he
yeah,
describes it as a love
100%,
letter to black women. And we talked about how black women are shaped, both of us, but also how as a community have been under pressure from several different directions, including from the black male community as well at certain points and through time. And, realizing that sometimes it's not you, it's just the system, does sound like it must be a really liberating experience to be able to take some of the pressure off yourself and to find that freedom to be able to do the things you want to do.
Yeah, taking off pressure without, it's not abdicating responsibility. You know, it doesn't stop me continuing to learn and grow. It's just meant that at times where I've pushed, where previously maybe I'd have tried to push and push and push and push, I've had to look back and go, do you know what? This is the system's telling me this opportunity is not for me. I'm going to take a step back, and then, you know, that's cool. You don't get a Colette in that space, then. You don't get a Colette in that space. And that's okay. You just don't get it's kind of a reframing, isn't it? Around the, you know, I really need this and I want this to actually, you don't get me. You don't get a me. You don't get me. You don't get the value of what I can bring to that space because this space is not built for me and I'm not going to burn myself out trying to enter it. You know, it was that's, you know, one of the reasons I left. Hindsight's 2020. That's one of the reasons that I am very pleased that I left my career in advertising. And although I kind of just basically burnt myself out of it, I think actually, as I slowly had this realization, and I've slowly gained this realization and knowledge over the years, it has stepped, it has increasingly helped me just step out of space and step out of, you know, career paths and stuff. But and as I've got more experienced, that process has just got gentler and gentler. Whereas at the beginning, it would be a very violent wrench. Probably I'd have to be fought, you know, forced out through burnout or just overwhelmed, whatever. And actually now it's a very gentle kind of redirection, which I'm really enjoying.
I think one of the things that's come through in this Black History Month miniseries that I've done, and I think I've probably said it on every one of the episodes I've recorded so far, is that the thing you're describing, it almost feels like you have to describe it and explain it. And it's a podcast, it's for people to listen and learn. So I understand that. But anyone who's been in the situation you've been in, the moment you said it, understood exactly what you meant. Right. I'm gonna dare to say that every black person in the UK listening to you is just silently nodding along, going, I know exactly what you mean. But they knew what you meant the moment you finished the first 10 seconds. But if you've never experienced that, you do need the explanation, don't you? You do need to try and bring that along a bit to help people kind of go, oh, this happens. I don't get that. I don't understand it because it's never happened to them.
The thing that's slightly frustrating, I guess. You're right. You're right. I think you're right on both counts. And I think there is something else. Oh God, there's two things I want to say, and I'm going to really try and hold them in my head so I remember to say both of them. The first one is that in the workplace, I'm not the only person. I'm not claiming this because I'm not the person. I'm not the first person to speak to this. David McQueen on LinkedIn says this all the time. But there is a sense of divide and conquer in the workplace. And that's the result of white supremacy. And the white supremacy tells you there can, we call it the Highlander thing. I saw it called the Highlander myth, and I really
there
love
can be only
Highlander.
one.
There can only be one, exactly, right? And there's this thing where, you know, so where there's one, not even black person, just general person of color, the white supremacy and the false narratives underneath it can be like, well, that's your spot done. So that person in turn's like, right, let me claim and hold on to my spot, and oh my God, and you know, that's it. No one else can come in this space. And then everybody else is like, well, in every space, therefore, so there might be several of you in a specific company, organization, sector. And everyone's sort of wary looking around going, okay, well, it's kind of my space. And also there's a fear of, there's consequences if you get together as a collective. So I find in very like white supremacist environments, and hostile spaces and toxic spaces, that the thing you know about that is that when people see two or more black people, or even, well, two or more black people, I'll speak from that experience, gathering, everyone's looking like, what are they talking about? They're plotting, they're bringing, you know, and it's like,
we're here to steal his soul. That's what we're here to do. We're here to steal his soul.
And I remember having it. I remember, like, I was working at an organization, and I had a very good friend who's black and worked in finance, worked in completely different teams. So we didn't really, our paths did just not overlap on the day to day. So every so often we'd sit down and have lunch, or if we saw each other in the corridor, we'd be like chatting. And I've noticed it's the parade of people walking past, just having a look. And I'm like, but I noted, to be clear, I would walk past and think, you know, this in the way that this company was laid out and set up, that it had like one big corridor. So frequently you'd see people standing in the corridor chatting, and everybody else would just, you'd see people barreling past, and there would be a stop and a look when it was me and my friend chatting. And I noted that. So I note that to say that there are two things that happen. There's this divide and conquer, which means that that divide and conquer stops us from collectively describing this stuff. So it has historically stopped people from, you know, sharing this truth in spaces outside of their nearest and dearest. So in professional spaces, people won't speak this truth very often. And then the counter, I knew that I would forget the second point. So the first point is around the divide and conquer. And then the second point about people recognizing it is that there's something happened in 2020, like, and the resurgence of Black Lives Matter movement. But it was very helpful to have a conversation about systemic and structural racism in the public domain. For the first time in kind of recent years and recent history, that's super useful. But what wasn't useful was then that happening without, I guess, I don't know, that happened and somehow, and I think again it's because of white supremacy where people go, oh, I don't understand, teach me. And you're like, hang on a minute. I mean, I'm experiencing the racism. So now I have to teach you about it too. Oh, and worse. All right. Sorry, the Assembly Network. Can you please do it for free? And I'm like, wow. I mean, I did not experience this because I'm a consultant. No one, to be clear, like no one, when Brand My Me started doing anti-racism work as part of our offer, which we've done as part of our social justice work for the time we've been set up, but we've always done it. I always talk about it, done it by stealth. So when we started being asked to do it openly, of course, no one's asking me to do that for free. Like, no one's asking us. We're a consultancy. That would be ridiculous. You can't possibly. Mm-hmm. Not you can't. People have tried. But the answers are very simple. No, there's no expectation. Whereas if it's your mates, or if it's your team members, or if it's your bosses coming to you and going, but I don't understand. I've not experienced this. Or worse, are you sure? Oh, I don't think it's that. And you're like, no, I am sure. This is my experience. It's really hard for me to educate you. Last thing I'm going to say on this is that it's even worse when, of course, to counter that, some amazing anti-racist thinkers, loads of them, loads of a breadth of anti-racist thinkers went to kind of save black people and maybe people of color from that effort. They went, let's put down our thoughts on socials, on blogs, on books. We're gonna do it. There's literally a book called What White People Need to Do Next. You cannot make this up. Like, there's so much literature. And then still people are going, What do I do? Teach me. And you're like, no. There's such a wealth of information out there. So I guess there's a, like, you're absolutely right. There's this thing about I speak it and people will hear it in 10 seconds. And now I've got so used to just explaining that. I mean, of course, we're a podcast. It'd be ridiculous if I just sat here and like 10 seconds and then was like.
Yeah, one word answers and are a pain for me. I'm like, oh, I need another question.
So of course, no, I know that here. And I actually, so there's two arenas I'd never mind doing it. And obviously this is a podcast. Of course, we're going to talk about it and I'm going to explain it. The second thing is also in my day job. It's my job to explain. So of course, let me be clear about this. Where Brand Mind Me clients, I'm literally after this, I'm about to go and do a 2-hour anti-racism session for a client. That's my job. Of course, we're going to be breaking it down. I'm going to be spending some time going through it. That's my job. I'm paid to do that. Of course, I love it. Actually, is also what I love to do. I don't so much love it if I'm at a networking event or at somewhere, you know, in my backyard having a barbecue or whatever. That's not when I want to have the conversation. So I think there is an acknowledgement there. Yeah, and I'm going to stop there. That was quite a lot.
Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis. I am the host of the show and the founder and strategy director at Eximo Marketing. I am joined today by Colette Phillip, who is the founder of Brand By Me. It's Colette, who you heard start the show, and who, let's just get back to listening to Colette talk about her work, about anti-racism, about brand building, and about how niching is the real superpower when it comes to being a consultant. If you want to get in touch, all the details are in the show notes. I would love to get your feedback to know what you think of the episode. I do love listening to that and reading it. It's fantastic. The good, the bad, and the ugly as well. I read them all. Thank you very much. Enough of me. Let's get in and have a listen to what Colette has to say. What a great start to the show there, Colette. Thank you for that. And let's just pick straight up on some of those themes and keep rolling through. Because I want to pick up on from a work perspective. And you mentioned, you know, you're going to do some anti-racism training and things like that. And I want to talk to you about language, about how people react to certain language, because you used a phrase in the beginning. You talked about white supremacist spaces. And I know from white people find that sort of language challenging when it, you know, because white supremacy means KKK to people, it means, you know, burning crosses and terrible things. So when that's used in a workspace, how do people react when you talk about workspaces in that way? And how do you counter that reaction?
It's so funny, isn't it? Because like, I realized this, it was probably in like midway through 2022. And I suddenly, and I remember I was just in a presentation and I literally was like to an organization, right, so here's how white supremacy shows up in your brand on a slide. And I sort of was in my back of my head, obviously, as I'm presenting it, thinking, I mean, I never thought I'd be saying those words in a work context ever, ever. And this is what I say at my day job. And now I probably do that like daily, twice daily. I'll be clear that Brand By Me is a social justice focused company. So we work with brands who are serious about social justice to help them look at what it means from a brand strategy point of view, tackle injustice, and that's the lens through which we do everything. So of course, and that means that if organizations are serious about social justice, one of the things they've realized, and for some large organizations, that did happen in and around 2020, that realization, but they realized that you need to lean into the discomfort about talking about this stuff. And discomfort is not the same as harm. And discomfort is not the same as lack of safety. And that prioritizing white comfort, it comes at the expense of safety and opportunity for Black people and people of color. So the organizations I work with, I guess, are already had that realization. Otherwise, they would not be paying for a consultancy to come in to help work with the brand team, the comms team, the fundraising team, the marketing teams on anti-racism and equity. They just wouldn't, you know, you're not going to be paying for that. So that's the first thing, I guess, is that actually, you know, there is something just about being clear about audience. I mean, when I say that, I have to be clear that my audience means that they may be slightly more receptive to this language, and I'm very clear at that. I guess the second thing about it is that, so in terms of, so I guess how do I tackle it? I guess let me talk about the reason I tackle it, and I'll talk about how, if people aren't comfortable with it. The reason I do that is because I realized pretty early on that when you only talk about racism without talking about the main reason why it was created, which was for white supremacy is the objective of racism, right? It was, they would literally designate people as white and then discriminate against everyone else. And when I say discriminate, I don't mean in a soft sense. I mean through violence, removing opportunity, resources, you know, through violence, through, you know, exploitation, all that sort of thing. And so I realized pretty early on, and I when I say I realized this, obviously what I mean by this is, because in applying this work to brand strategy, it's a slightly different arena of anti-racism work that maybe is kind of documented and is the books and the training and stuff. It's a slightly different lens on it. So when I had the realization that if you only talk about racism, it's sort of placing the energy in the wrong place. So people start to frame it as one of two things. In the spaces that I'm in, people would start to think of it as either an issue that resides with the global majority and Black people and people of color, like that's where it resides. And therefore, you know, you're sort of, people are looking to our community, therefore to our communities to find the solution. And I'm like, no. Whereas if it redirects it and you're talking about the root reason when you're talking about white supremacy. So I had to shift the work. How I talk about people if they're uncomfortable is we do a bit of thing at the beginning. I'm always a bit like, you know, we always talk about leaning into discomfort and what that means to preempt it. And then when I do, I'm very clear about why we're talking about it. And I'm like, you're going to have to just keep hearing it. And interestingly, yeah, it's not pushback because people, as I said, because I'm in spaces where people, you know, these organizations are set up, meant to be set up to tackle social justice. So in some form or other, or certainly the programs that they're delivering are. So the pushback is sometimes insidious and subtle, and it'll come from a point of view of, oh, I'm just not sure people understand it. Or maybe that's jargon. Perhaps we should say this because it's a term that's widely understood. And so I just have to push it back Like, no, we're not going to do that. But, you know, not pretty much that. I was going to say, I'd say it a bit nicer. I don't really think I do. I do say it nicer. I say it like this. Okay, no, we're not going to do that because we need to really name this and name it as the root cause of racism. So, of course, we must talk about racism, but we must also talk about white supremacy. And here's why. So I don't know if that sounds nicer to you or not, but it's the same words. You know, and that's how we have to deal with it.
It's interesting that the role language plays in the whole history of racism, but also in how it's tackled now, and how it can make people feel and change their perceptions of it. And I think sometimes using language as a way to crash into a subject is really important because it's hard for some people on the other side of racism, for white people to fully understand sometimes what those feelings are like, and those feelings of when you just know what the reason is, but you can't ever put your finger on it because no one's ever said it out loud. It's hard to really describe that. But if you can crash into something and say, right, let's have this discussion in the round in a different way and change people's perception on the discussion, just moves their point of view on what they're looking at. And talking about it, it's not something I've ever done before. And talk about it in the roles of, you know, white supremacy. But as soon as you said it, I was like, what that does is it moves how you view the problem from where you are here to over here and forces you to look at it in a different way. So it's an interesting way how language has that power to be able to change perception with just a phrase. It's really important. Yeah.
And also the thing you have to also language is incredibly important. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because language is at once incredibly important, but it also, too much of the work gets caught up in language and terminology, which is not useful. Then if it becomes this debate. So because language also, what the systems of oppression, like kind of racism and sexism, one of the things that we know is that language is very quickly co-opted weaponized. So there'll be language. So let's use the word woke as an example. It was language that arose out of liberation, designed for Black communities in the US to talk about their own awakening to the reality of injustice. That's what it was used for. It was then co-opted. So at its first, it was co-opted first by liberals to just mean liberal and stuff. And yeah, I get it. Liberals, I get it. I'm liberal. That's co-opted. And therefore, because it was co-opted, it was able to be weaponized. So of course, and we have to be really clear about, I guess, that journey. Like when we're thinking about language, because we don't get hung up on language. Like I remember like all the time being spent debating BAME, BME, etc. Now, of course, those terms are wrong. But once we've decided that those terms, it's not okay, you know, those terms are wrong, and we've explained why. Those terms are wrong because they, you know, they act as a collective umbrella for very different communities with, of course, shared experience. But also, we can't. It was allowing institutions and governments to mask the complexity and also like hide their white supremacy behind this big umbrella term. So we have to be clear about why we're not using that anymore. But it wasn't. The debate became about BAME, BME, and then you go, okay, so because actually what you'll then do is just replace it with another term. So it's like actually, and there was so much time spent debating the language, not the why, that actually people thought the act of change, stop using BAME, that's their anti-racism work done. You're like, no, what? No. And then when the UK government were like, well, we're proudly not using BAME, and I'm like, yeah, but you're horribly championing institutional racism at every level. So like, I don't really care what language you're using. Like, it's horrendous. Like, I don't really care about. I mean, I do care. To be clear,
no,
I do.
No,
care.
But I know you.
I do care. But that, let's be clear about that. That's not the work. That's not the work. Don't stop. And certainly, we are not applauding you for that. No, that's just the basics of what you should be doing as as government organizations. It's the basics. Probably not using harmful language is like the basis of it. So, language is super important. We need to be careful that it doesn't become the whole conversation, but actually it can allow us to have some really brilliant conversations. And as you said, particularly sometimes it allows us to, I mean, I'm a big one, like obviously being a brand strategist, I'm a big one about, one of our values is like clarity, because I'm a big one about clarity. There's too much words and meaning and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, we just need to, one of my stock phrases of my colleagues over the years, anyone that knows me, I say it less now because I'm in my own business. I think it's because I'm just, you know, because people generally are clearer when I'm in it's my own business. But when I worked, whether it was particularly when I worked in-house in brand teams, I used to say that I start everything with let's be clear, because can I just get clear on that? Or let's be clear, but let's be clear was my stop, and people were like, let's be clear. And people, it was like a catchphrase, because I'm like, so often there was just so much like woolly, vague, just stuff, nonsense and words and stuff, particularly around marketing and brand. And I'm like, ugh, everyone's just getting caught up in all of this sea of super words. And so I'd be like, let's be clear. Here's what we mean. So we're all on the same page, so we're clear. And so I think that clarity is super important.
I do something in workshops with clients sometimes where like, I tend to try and get people from across the organization into a workshop at various stages.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, so job number one is let's just everybody take a moment and without sharing, without picking your phone up, without checking anything, write down what the organization's mission statement is.
Love this. Yeah,
and then
when
you finish that, write down the values. And really, honestly, I've got leadership teams in there and people all the way through. The only people who ever get it right are either the brand team if they've just redone it, and new starters, because they've been all over the website a lot in the last 6 months, right? Trying to get in and get the job sorted. But other than that, nobody ever gets it right. And why? Yeah. It's because the mission statement is like three paragraphs long, so no one can remember it. And the values are, which one of our 22 values are we living today? And you're like, oh, God. This isn't about we're going to change it. That's not necessarily what I do. But it's like, this is the thing that should be guiding us all in how we're going to do
it's bad
thing.
Brand. It's the hallmarks of bad brand. I remember like doing some work with an organization, and I always talk about it. Now I've forgotten what they're called. You know, when the individual words, the capital letter of each one, then spelled
like an acronym of it.
Yeah, but it's not called, they're called something else. But yeah,
an acrostic. Is it an acrostic?
Acrostic, yeah. It's acrostic. An acrostic. So, and their values were spelled out on acrostic, except the acrostic was like, I think it was like an 8 to 10 letter word. And the individual the values were all, they were rubbish. And three of them were synonyms for the same word. So I was like, this, they spent so long thinking about
acrostic
that it was like, so, and people try and do really clever things like that. And then also, so yeah, there is a lot in that, like, but it is a hallmark of like bad brand, I will go, because I will say that I will give like the two examples. Well, I've done many, many brand projects even before I set up my own consultancy, but I remember when we worked at I worked for an animal charity called World Animal Protection, and our purpose was, we moved, and it was a global organization, so you couldn't be, and our purpose was simply, we moved the world to protect animals, which sounds super obvious, but I was like, yes, we moved the world, there's tangible shift to protect animals. And if you'd have asked the organization, I thought we did a little test, people all remembered it. They were like, yes, we moved the world to protect animals, and it's like, move, and we used it. It was super clear and simple, and that's what you want. I remember as well, when I was at Barnardo's, we developed, I think this was a new personality. One of the personality traits, and it was the one that was super sticky, was terrier-like. And it was the one that the organization, because it was a word of saying to that, tenacity and terrier-like. But it was really, really good in terms of both the brand personality, but also how the organization showed up in the work that Barnardo's did at that point. God, like 12 years ago, or whatever, with vulnerable and the hardest to reach children. Like, and it was this terrier-like thing. It was such a sticky word. Everyone always remembered it, and they loved it. And it was one of our personality traits. Even I now, 12 years on, don't remember any of the others. But the point is that there's ones that you need to make it really sticky, and you need to make the language sticky, and it needs to be super simple and clear, especially if you're in global organizations. It's really important. And I really love that energy of doing it. And also, the other thing I find is that people, I really, really, this really frustrates me is when, I said this, it's a hallmark, I'm going to say as well, I'm going to be really blunt, I think it's a hallmark of it's a hallmark of poor consultancy, is when you have language, as long as, when you said that, like, if everybody comes into your organization, everyone's saying different things, no one remembers it, that needs to be changed. But if people understand something, as long as everyone understands it, even if it's your consultancy not understanding what that word technically dictionary means, as long as everybody in the organization understands what that is and they get it, that's cool. You don't then come in and mess with it. So I've had it on a few occasions where consultants have come in, consultancies, big and small, no names, big and small. I think it's a mindset of a specific, maybe demographic of a consultant, but anyway, as opposed to actually the size of the organization they work for, but who come in and go, oh, well, that's technically not that's a verb, so values are meant to be nouns, so we need to change it. And it's like, nope, please don't, because actually the value is our principle. As long as the principle can be articulated in the way the organization is going to get. So if you're if you have a very staticky theoretical organization, you're going to want them to be active words so that people will actually get up and do stuff. That's the language of brand. That's the flexibility. It is not about this sort of ridiculous grammar exercise. And I see that also, where it's another way where people are like, well, you know, the kind of well actually thing. Well, actually, you know, values are supposed to be nouns. So, you know, you're like, well, that's not really a thing. Like, it isn't.
Values are supposed to be lived, right? That's it. That if people aren't actively bringing them to life and displaying them every day, verbs or nouns aren't important. It's how they are brought to life that's important, right? And the most important part to me of those is that they have to be memorable.
Yeah.
Because if people can't remember them, they can't deliver them. And
yeah.
So
yeah.
Verbs and nouns is completely, it doesn't matter.
It's irrelevant,
it doesn't
matter. But it's really great. What they have is, and then like, you see people, they're like, yes, here's our 10 values. But I'm like, no, I'm sorry, that's never going to work. And then when you look at it, you're like, well, no, you've got 3 values. The other 7, people aren't doing the other 7. Like, there's 3,
yeah.
And there are 3 that really count here. There are 3 that are really relevant. The others are just like, I don't know, that's just more words.
Yeah. And what's your view on when you see honesty or trustworthy as part of a value set? I'm not trying to throw you under a bus here or anything like that. I just, it drives me wild when I see it. I'm like, come on, this is just like this is, we have to be this anyway, right? We shouldn't have to spell it out.
Sometimes I do. Like, so if it's, it depends, I guess. My thought is it depends because, yeah, I'm not a fan of words like, you know, the lowest common denominator words. But so, for example, okay, but it depends on the sector. Because although it should be a given, it often isn't. So if you are in a sector where there is a lot of fraud, you may want to have honesty as one of your values to make sure that people, because it's what you said, values have to be lived. So if you're looking to have values that people, so you may want to. Same with, I trustworthy, less so, but because I think it needs to be earned.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can put that into a value or personality trait. I think that needs to be earned. So I might express the value that sits behind it and then trust is the output, if that makes sense. So what is it then about? What do you need to do that need your customers, consumers to trust you? And therefore that is what your value stroke personality trait, whichever one it sits in. But yeah, that's what I would do. Probably with that one, I might work it backwards. But the honesty thing, no, I think it depends. Like sometimes you would hope it's a given, but honestly, it kind of isn't. So for me, also I'll go a personal level. Sometimes as well, I'm like, if it's founder-led businesses, I'm like, maybe that belongs in your personal brand. So well, my personal value is honesty because it is something that is a hallmark of how I show up. And it is actually one of those things that is a very much a characteristic. And it's not a given. And when I say honesty, it stretches into stuff like, so honesty is a personal value of mine, but it's not one of Brand By Me's values. It just isn't, honesty is not one of ours, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a bit more about Brand By Me. You set it up nearly 8 years ago now? So 2016. And has it evolved over time? What sort of work, you know, how has it, tell us the story of Brand By Me.
So the story of Brand By Me was I was working at a global animal charity. That was the last day job I did before, like not day job, the last, you know, in-house like employee job before I set up my own business. So I was working with an animal charity and I got to a stage where I hit a ceiling in terms of, you know, I wanted to be sort of executive leadership team level, and I was doing work that would probably put me at that level, and I was sort of, you know, that I was leading things that would put me at that level, and I was there and I was ready to be, but I sort of hit one of those realizations that maybe the system, not me, and this ain't going to happen here. And I need to, so I was like, okay, rather than just go and bounce into another job, I just need to take some time, look at my career a bit differently. So I was going to take a career break, and I did take a career. It's maybe 3 months. I saved up a load of money and I was going to have a really nice time. Just going to go off travel for a bit, and I was going to do some things, and not travel like extensively, like global travel, but just go and see mates around the world and stuff, and just go and have a nice time and spend some time like just doing nice things for like 3 months. That's what I decided. So
I get the feeling that didn't work out for you.
I spent 3 weeks, and then I woke up and I was like, and I literally, I'll say this, I woke up and I was like, oh yeah, I need to set up my own business. Oh, and it's going to be called Brand By Me, and it's going to be about brands that do good. That's what it's going to be about. So, I'm like, actually, when I realized, God, because, you know, I really loved. So when I did a big global rebrand for that charity, World Animal Protection, and we worked with Wolf Olins, the brand agency, which it was so gorgeous because, and the reason we did was because I had just come from, my previous job had been at EE, and we'd worked with Wolf Olins on EE, and then Wolf Olins were like, oh my, when I was leaving, they were like, okay, if there's anything we can do to help you out, like, you know, we really love working with you. If there's anything we can do to help you as you're leaving, whatever you could do next, good luck. And I was like, well, actually, my next job is going to be a rebrand. Would you like to come and help me with this rebrand for this tiny animal charity? Oh, and MB, obviously we're not EE, so
yeah. We haven't got that budget.
You're going to need to give us a very significant, massive, massive, massive discount. And they did, so that was awesome. And it was really great. But what it meant was, and I'm not a big fan of pro bono work from a brand strategy point of view, even for charity. I mean, if you're a charity with some resources, even if it's limited, just because if it's pro bono, you kind of have to get what you're given. It's the power dynamic is off, which is the language I now have for it. At the time, I would just say I don't think that people value stuff they don't necessarily pay for in this context, and the organization doesn't value it either. So people mm-hmm. take it for granted. People won't. So I'm like, actually, it's just easier. Even if you've got a minimal budget, you use that minimal budget and make it go as far as you can. And that's what. So for this minimal budget, I was like, well, I am a brand strategist, so I do need the agency for help in certain things. So I was very targeted, and I thought. When at that time it changed now, but at that time I was looking around, I was like, I just couldn't see. That was the dream as well. I just couldn't see like strategic level, big brand level, sort of really strategic, robust support that you'd need as a brand director, but on a micro scale that maybe a smaller organization might need. I didn't see it anywhere. I saw there were lots of branding consultancies heavy on the design side, heavy on the identity side that would do design work, but it wasn't that strategy thinking just wasn't, you couldn't afford it. So the strategy would always come at a premium. So it's like, well, if you get the basic logo, that's going to be here. But if you want the strategy thinking, we're going to charge you loads more for that. And I was like, it's got to be another way. And that was Brand by Me. And then it has it evolved? Yeah, because the world's changed. The language of, I think, what I've wanted to do with Brand by Me hasn't changed, but maybe where, who, what, and where our support has needed has evolved, and therefore our offer has significantly evolved. Our client base has changed. And that's also, I guess, as we've got a reputation and stuff, the client base has changed. So we started off, because I was like, I live in Hitchin in Hertfordshire, so I live outside London. And when I'd spent like 5-6 years commuting into London, so I was like, I don't want to work in London anymore. So at first I was like, I don't really want to go into London. So first of all, I was working with small to medium sized charities and founder led businesses. Was that because I was like, that can drive change, and it was really nice for the scale we were at now. But it shifted over time. And then I was like, larger and larger charities and social justice focused organizations, and the world stuff. And then it became social justice focused charities, but it was quite niche because actually people, it was niche. But then in 2020, not just the resurgence of Black Lives Matter, but also the very same but different experience of the pandemic. By that I mean, it's something that everybody's experiencing, but injustice means inequity means you experience it very differently. It was just like this global big conversation about justice and equity. And that was like, okay. And then suddenly it's like, and you've got brand teams going, yeah, we need to do stuff. And it can't just be tick box and DEI or whatever. We've got to actually look at this. And then I was like, well, actually I know how to do this because that's how we build brands.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the evolution of it.
So a question I asked Kevin, because Kevin formed POC, People of Creative Collective. Anyway, so he started POC, and I asked him a question about when you started, did you just get the black briefs, for want of a better phrase, right? Were people just like, oh, we can give this one because this is our diverse little bit of budget? And he's like, yeah, we used to get that. And you can see them coming and we'd just be like, yeah, no, take that back. We don't want to work with you. That's not how this works. Did you find, as you start after 2020, did you find that like the profile of people coming to you had changed, but maybe not for, for people looking, oh, we need to do something, so let's go and talk to Colette? Or did you find that people are actually just, no, actually, we are open to this. It's not a box ticking exercise. We are on the path to do this correctly.
The second one, but that's because there's like, when you put into your like brand, we only work with people that are serious about social justice. I think enough of what I put out into the world in terms of content, speaking ops, is super clear. And, I am the founder, so Brand by Me isn't just me, like there's 7 of us, but I am the founder, so therefore kind of it will obviously, who I am really shapes the business and how we show up. So I think the content we put out, it's very easy to put off people that aren't serious, like really early on. So it probably wouldn't even be a conversation. It probably be that they'll be put off by that the follow up email they get. Like if they approach and it's something tick boxy, yeah. I'm a bit like, nah, that's not us. And normally, to be honest, if they're approaching with something tick boxy, the budget will be at a level that we can't work with them. Like, no, you need to do something much more for that budget.
Yeah, a bit punchier. Yeah, I have a from a personal perspective with my company. So I'm marketing strategy. I don't tend to. I do bits of sort of diversity, equity, inclusion work, but it kind of spins out of marketing strategy as opposed to people coming directly to me for that type of thing. I do a few presentations on Black History Month and that, and they're personal stories, that type of thing. But I do notice that I speak to companies when I do those training sessions who are on a journey, are already well on that journey and open to listening to it. And there's a bit of me that thinks, well, yeah, but we're already preaching to the people who want to listen about this. How do we tackle people who are at a very early stage in that? And then I often come around to it's like, there's enough problems in the world. I'm going to fight the battles that I can fight. But I do think sometimes, should I be working harder to get to people who haven't started that journey yet? Because that's where you can have the most impact. But that also sounds really tiring to me. Is that a discussion you've had with yourself and with other people in the company?
Well, not me. No. So when I say this, have I had discussion? It's not so much a discussion as we're not doing that. Because I'm like, as a Black woman, I'm not tiring myself out to work with people. But I'm also, it's interesting. I pick up on something you said about, like, we don't do DEI work. I've got to be clear about that. Like,
yeah.
We do equity and anti-oppression and how that, what that means for brand strategy. And we do anti-racism and what that might mean for brand strategy. We don't do DEI work.
Yeah.
Where people, and that's important only because people often come to us and they're like, oh, DEI work. And I'm like, we don't do that. Like, if you want this, like you need to find a DEI. I might also sometimes, depending on who it is, I might go, do you really want DEI work? Or do you actually want this specific thing? But if you want DEI work, there's that kind of, there's those preferred consultants over there to go to. But no, I think that in terms of, I do think, so I guess this work, anti-racism work certainly, and anti-oppression work is a lifelong journey, but particularly anti-racism is. Because of the systems that we're dealing and tackling, it is not something you do as a one-off project. It's not something you start and then, you know, you can just leave and then it's ongoing work. So wherever people are on the journey, there are people to work with them at every stage. So there are some excellent resources for organizations that are at the start, very start of their journey. I might, you know, that's not the role for Brand By Me, because the minute you're needing to look at your brand, your comms, your marketing strategy, like your fundraising, like, and look at it and what it means for what this means, what anti-racism, what it means to be anti-racist in these spaces, but also how this can support, how these disciplines can support your anti-racism work, you need to have been done some work already. So at the point where we're coming in, it is necessary for you as an organization to have done some work. I will argue that it probably isn't the starting. If the starting place is look at what can our brand do, I'm going to be like, that's the wrong place to start. Like, yeah, it is the wrong place to start, because what you're effectively doing is like, what the question you may well find yourself asking is, how can we make our brand look like we're more anti-racist, which is just not that. That's not it. That's not the thing. And you might find that. And what's interesting is often when we work with organizations, sometimes internally, my direct clients might get a little bit of pushback from people wider in the organization. Like, why on earth are you starting with the brand? And they're like, we're not starting with the brand. We've done this work of stuff. But actually, if we don't look at the brand, and I equip them with this, I guess, is that if you don't look at the brand massively just works against you, because as we know, brand and marketing as disciplines are steeped in oppressive practice. They are built, they are one, it can be, they can, at least if they're not the system, but they are part of that system that is built to exclude. And unless you do some quiet things at a strategic level, you're going to find that's going to happen. So often the problem that clients come to me with is, we've been on our, normally we're on a DEI journey, or we've been doing anti-racism work, and either our brand is working against us. Our comms aren't working. Our comms team don't understand it. Our marketing teams are just not clear what to do next. All the marketing teams come and say, look, we've been doing this work, but we don't understand how this applies to us. We understand it and we really want to do it, but we can't understand how this is going to apply to us, how we make this work. And that's where we enter.
Yeah. What I like, to go back to something you said earlier, is clarity. You know, like, no, this is, if you look there, that's not for us. If you're in this bit of your journey, you're for us. And if you're there, that's not for us. Clarity. Mm.
Yeah, it's really important. The more specific I was, the more specific. I think the most specific. It's the opposite actually, because I think again, scarcity mindset tells you do everything you can get your hands on. But in reality, that's just nonsense. You have to, I think, focusing and being specific about where and how you can help will just help you be better. It's like you're just better then.
I, you know, the question I started with, I wish, what's the one thing you knew 10 years ago? That last 10 seconds of what you just said is that, right? My career background is quite diverse and has dropped into different jobs. We've done B2B, I've done B2C, I've done this, I've done that. And this isn't supposed to sound arrogant. I feel like I could turn my hand to a marketing role in about a dozen different types of company. But take that mindset into running your own company and it's a fucking disaster, right? Because you're just like, I think I can do everything for everyone, and you can't, right? Well, you can, but just trying to sell that is the most painful thing ever, right? Every sale is like day one all over again.
When people go, I used to do a lot, as I said, I used to start life by doing work with sort of small ambitious businesses. And when I started my company working with small ambitious businesses, I go to networking, like, a bit of everything really, and I'd be like, I can't see how that will work. But and although you can do many things, and this is what I've realized, is that although you can do many things, it's better that you just talk about a few of them. You can do many, many things. I have no doubt, like, people are very skilled, highly skilled, and can do a breadth of. And that's the joy of running your own business, is that you get to do this breadth of amazing stuff, but you need to funnel it through a really clear sort of vehicle that people understand.
Yeah. And that's the thing, because when people understand it, the sales cycle shortens, right? You get that positioning right and people go, you do this thing, we want you to do that. How much does it cost?
Yes.
My sales cycle for the first 3 to 4 years of the company, every sales deal took forever because it was all bespoke, starting from scratch. Yes. Like, this is madness. So
yeah. Yeah, I agree. I find the same. I think that's part of the journey to go on now. It's like exactly what you just said. I love it. It's like, you do this, you did it for that person. Can we do it for us? Good. And how much does it cost?
Yeah.
And that's done. Perfect. This is really easy.
Right. I've got one more question to ask before you go. And hopefully it's a short one. Might not be a short one, but hopefully it is. Give us a book recommendation, something people should read or could read about this subject. It might be marketing. It might be about anti-racism. Could be something completely different. It might just been a novel you read yesterday and you thought, you know what, I love that. But what book would you recommend to people?
What White People Can Do Next by Emma Dabiri is great as a just for black people of color, white people alike, actually, on anti-racism. I think it's because it's really practical. It's like, here, boom, 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 and it really stands up. Nova Reid, The Good Ally, is gorgeous. When I first looked at it, I was like, oh, this is very much targeted at white people, and therefore I'm not going to read it. And then my husband's white, so I gave it to him to read. And then I came back to it and I was like, actually, there's just some gorgeous stuff in here about it's your when you're reading it, your lens is different. So for me, reading it, it's just very good on some reminding me of how to hold compassionate, empathetic, but really gritty conversations about this stuff. And Nova does that beautifully. Like, she holds this amazing kind of compassionate, kind of warm, understanding spaces, but I feel like sometimes I've seen, not in books or anybody that's anti-racism, but certainly in the DEI space, I see people are giving their clients and organization just a massive out at every stage. Well, it's this, it's unconscious, it's blah, and it's blah. Well, actually, Nova does none of that, but she still manages to hold really compassionate spaces, which is gorgeous. And she does that in person, but equally in her books. It's just amazing. So that's the second one. And the third one is a book I read on holiday by Yomi Adeyoke called The List. And Yomi Adeyoke was one of the co-authors of Slaying Your Lane and a number of years ago. And this is her first non-fiction and her first fiction book. And it's a brilliant book for our time. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's like a page turner. It's amazing. So they're my three at the moment.
Perfect. Three books that no one in Four Seasons has mentioned either. So that is fantastic to do. And if you're listening, the details of all those books are in the show notes with an easy clickable link. So thank you very much for that, Colette. We'll put your details of Brand By Me in the show notes as well. And thank you very much for your time. It's been amazing having you on the strategy sessions.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.